check your privilege here. Like, that is the height of privilege, that you have decided that you can make that decision on behalf of an immigrant family who have no other options academically and educationally.
Welcome back to a new episode of The Kevin Roberts Show. This is an exciting time. We're sitting here recording this episode at the end of the year when many of us are casting our gaze toward Christmas and the new year. And our friend here, who's a Heritage alum and a new friend of mine, Bethany Mandel, co-author of Stolen Youth, is someone who said, you know what, Kevin, I think you should introduce me as your Jewish friend who's willing to be here during the Christmas season. So there we are, Bethany.
Thanks
for being here.
Jew.
The go-to Jew. There you go. Thank you for that and your wonderful sense of humor. And as I told you, as you were walking into the studio, I've been following your work for years. And truly.
Wild.
Yeah, it is wild. And the book's great. As I told you, I only had time this morning to do the old graduate school skim, but I homed in on a couple sections we'll talk about. We're going to get into the book. And by the way, you really should read the book. I'm going to give this as a gift. I haven't decided whether to my wife or to our eldest daughter, who's an aspiring writer.
Interesting.
And I think it's going to be a good motivator for her. But we'll jump into your story first. You are someone, just to back up a step, that those of us on the political right, regardless of our religious affiliation, see as having the gift of telling the truth, even when it hurts. Thank you for that.
Yeah, that's a skill of mine.
So how did you get to this point? I mean, you really are. I'm not being patronizing. You really are one of the intellectual leaders of our movement. And you don't see yourself that way, which is interesting.
No.
You should.
So I started here. And it was funny when the security guard brought me in, I felt like such an old lady because, like, this used to be this, this used to be that. And I remember thinking, like, oh, people used to come in here and show me around Heritage and what it used to be. My eyes would glaze over. I'm like, I don't care. And now I've become that person, like, 14 years later.
It eventually happens to us.
I know. We all turn into the older version of ourselves, which are better than the older version, like the past versions
right.
of ourselves. But I started here. I guess it was about 14 years ago in the fundraising department at Heritage. When I first moved to Washington, I wanted to work here, but had no way of actually working here because I had no talents or expertise or connections or anything. So I worked at like a synagogue doing busy work for a year. But I lived down the street from Heritage. I lived in Northeast. And so I would walk past Heritage and put my foot on the bell every time I walked back and forth from my house and say, like, one day I'm going to work there. And then I worked here and it was amazing and it was a dream. And every time I come here, not for the Christmas party, which y'all don't invite me to, but it's fine. But anytime I come here otherwise, I take pictures of my kids on the bell. And so I have this like 10-year progression of pictures of my kids on the bell. And like sometimes it's in the middle of summer and their butts are burning and they're complaining that they're sitting on the pavement
this
outside.
Is good formation.
And I don't care. We got the picture. But I mean, this is where I started was Heritage. And then I got poached by Commentary Magazine, but this is where it started.
What a cool story! I didn't know the details of that background,
yeah.
and I'm envisioning these elevator rides with Ed Fulner, who is
so painful
for whatever reason, a devotee of the show.
Oh no!
No, this
oh,
is
no,
great.
Of course he is. Why did I say that story?
No, this is
of
awesome.
Course. Oh
so,
no!
From quote unquote no talent to the go-to Jew of the Kevin Roberts Show, it's great to be spending time with you. What motivated you to write this book? Well, I mean, there's usually a moment, right. when, especially for a writer, and obviously you do have writing skills, among others, other skills, there's this moment where you say, I'm going to do it. Because it's a big undertaking,
yeah.
especially when you have six kids.
I regret it. A little bit. So I found out that I was pregnant. No, wait, that's not true. I signed the contract when I was like, several weeks postpartum with my fifth. And then I wrote the book, his whole first year of life. And then I finished it and I was like, oh, thank God. I can't believe I survived that. And then the edits came back and I was 6 weeks pregnant with my sixth. And that is something I would not wish on my worst enemy. And then I had to go through the editing process where all I wanted to do was sleep, but then I had to edit it. And then I was like, thank God. I really got past it now. And then the book was released when I was 6 weeks postpartum with my sixth. So the timing was not optimal on any fronts, but I felt like it was a moment that I had to, I had to capture. And I was, me and Carol were some of the only people who were talking about how all of this ideological indoctrination, everyone's talking about it on the college level, everyone's talking about it in business, but it's happening in kindergarten, it's happening in preschool, for God's sake. And I think that a lot of writers are reticent to be mommy bloggers and reticent to talk about children's issues because we don't want to get pigeonholed, because people think we're dumb just because we're mothers. And, you know, I'm also a stay-at-home mom, and people, when I meet people who are like sort of random folks who I don't know their political affiliations and I don't want to ruin my kids' friendships, I'll say, yeah, I'm a homeschool mom and I stay home and sometimes I write stuff, but I like not that much. Like most of my time I'm just home with my kids. And when I say that, there's no right answer, because when I say that, people are like, oh, so you just don't do anything.
You're just sitting around enjoying a lazy
eating
life.
Eating bonbons, right? Yeah, right. With my six children, 10 and under. But I think that there is a growing openness among writers to talk about these issues, but we were the first to do that. And it was because we were just seeing, I mean, it was funny. Carol and I have been talking about writing a book for a lot of years, and we had a hard time sort of narrowing in on one. And we decided to think about writing this book, and we opened a Google Doc and we said, let's just like see if we have enough. I don't know if we have enough. And then we did the Google Doc and we realized like, we have too much. How do we write this in just 200 pages? And it was hard. It was hard to sort of narrow down all of these different areas where, I mean, school was very easy chapter. Carol got that easy chapter. But there was a lot of, I mean, there was a lot of like essence of it. When I go to the zoo with my kids and every single explanation on the wall is about global warming, and I'm like, why don't you just tell them about how much elephants poop? Like, that's what they want to know. They want to know how much elephants poop.
That's all they're interested in.
Yes. And like, let's just stop feeding the beast of anxiety and fear. And, you know, we talk a lot about all of the ways that kids are not doing great now. And a lot of that is put on social media. But a lot of it is also because parents and teachers and sort of thought leaders in the education space, including in, you know, museum, whatever, science, are throwing all of this fear-mongering stuff about guns, about the environment. And like, lo and behold, kids are basket cases. And that's, I mean, that's by design. That's not an accident.
Of all of the institutions where our kid that have robbed our kids of their innocence, there's no other way of putting it. Is there one institution or one story about a particular institution that really surprised you as you were getting into the research of the book?
I mean, the schools, honestly. That's where kids are spending the vast majority of their waking hours. And so many of the parents that I spoke to said, it feels like they're working against us. It feels like we have, and it's true, we know what is best for our children. We know how they learn. We know what we don't want them to learn. And the schools have decided this is the curriculum, whether you like it or not. There's a story. I live in Montgomery County, Maryland, which is the craziest place in America, I feel, outside of the Bay Area. And I wrote a piece for the Free Press maybe like 3 or 4 months ago, maybe more than that. Time blends when you have six children, 10 and under. And the school district where I live decided that all of the LGBT curriculum stuff is not optional. You have to learn from pre-K on. And they won't tell the parents the days that they're doing it because they don't want to give people the option to pull their kids out and have an unexcused absence. So they've removed the opt-out option in Montgomery County. And what's really interesting is Montgomery County prides itself on its inclusivity and diversity and yada, yada. And the parents who are the loudest are religious Muslim parents, mostly immigrants. And they are like, we don't care. We've decided that your children, your religious Muslim children, have to learn about Pride Month all year long. It's not Pride Month anymore. Now it's just annual Pride.
What have those families done? Because I presume, so, you know, economically, many of them feel like they don't have a choice to pull their kids out.
They don't have a choice. Yeah. I mean, so I'm in a chat with a lot of them, and the overwhelming majority, a lot of them want to go to Islamic schools, but there's also no space. Like, there's the financial consideration, but it's also like the exponential growth just isn't possible on a dime like that. But a lot of them have tried to form personal connections with their kids, teachers, and principals, and on the side said, like, you know, I understand it's policy, but look me in the eye and tell me that this is what you're going to do. And a lot of the teachers are not comfortable with it either, because not necessarily that they don't align with it ideologically, but they also feel like this puts me in an adversarial relationship with these kids' parents, who I'm going to have to deal with on a myriad of issues that are far more important than a pride book.
And it really shows you, this is going perhaps a little too far into the weeds as it relates to education reform, but something that I've learned, it shows you that all teachers are not the quote-unquote enemy here.
Yeah.
The enemy would be the ridiculous administrators, yep, goofy intellectuals who have somehow been able to infiltrate these institutions. We'll talk about that. And the teachers often feel very helpless about, mm-hmm, this. And yeah, so that's a way of saying, because before we conclude the conversation many, many, many minutes from now, we will talk about next steps for people who are watching or listening. And one of them would be, don't think that the teacher automatically is your enemy. They actually can be your ally, yeah, like you're explaining here.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of the, I mean, I get people who feed me stuff and like will take pictures during teacher trainings and everything. There's a lot, I would say the vast majority of parents or teachers in Montgomery County are not comfortable with this. And it's also, you know, for every minute, and Carol says this all the time, for every minute you spend on woke indoctrination, you're taking away instructional time in math and English. And everyone across the board, from the teachers to the parents, and in often cases the students themselves, realize that they are lagging really far behind. In my local elementary school, where my children would go if they went to their local public school, in fourth grade, I'm almost certain my numbers are right, but they're in the vicinity of right. 5.3% of them are on level with English, and 3-ish% are on level with math. I know it's below 10% and not like just shy of 10%.
It's unfathomable.
Yeah. Yeah. We've really done a real disservice to this generation. And also keep in mind that you're thinking of standards that are already too low. So one of my favorite examples of like how far this has fallen is Alexander Hamilton. When he applied to get into Princeton, the standards to get into undergraduate are higher than they are to graduate with a master's from Princeton. Just to get in, he had to hit a benchmark that most graduates of Princeton could not hit now.
The social, cultural, economic, political implications of that statistic about reading ability in fourth grade will go on for two or three, yeah, generations.
Yeah. And it'll reverberate in so many ways that we can't even imagine. It's the unknown unknowns, the famous Dick Cheney line. We know that it will lead to crime. We know it will lead to depression. We know it will lead to economic turmoil. We don't know what else it could lead to. And that to me is equally scary. I mean, I don't want to get like too dire. This is 5 days before Christmas.
It's okay.
But like,
we do dire on this show, but we always offset that at the end with some hopefulness.
Well, I think that being a prepper isn't the worst idea.
Good. I've been a prepper for many years. Yeah. Yeah. Might surprise people. The President Heritage Foundation is a prepper. Although people who have worked with me for years are not at all surprised by that. The next question, though, I think is from the standpoint of the political left. And by that, I mean, it is astonishing to me that friends on the political left, the few who still count me as a friend, cannot explain to me how they can defend the hijacking of one of their core political principles, which is economic equality or economic opportunity for poor kids, yeah, by the woke agenda, which clearly is robbing these students, mm-hmm, disproportionately those students, of the ability to get ahead in American society. Yeah. I've not yet seen a defense of that that's persuasive.
Yeah, I mean, the argument is, I'm like a former leftist, so I have a lot of these friends also, and I see their stuff, I talk to them, and the argument is there are more important things than academic advancement. And I think that's true, honestly. When my kids graduate, wherever they graduate, my home school or a private school, wherever they go, I value some things more than others. I value their their morality and their values. And we have different values, but those are the values and the importance that I have for my own children and my own family. What I think is really galling about what the left is doing is they're making decisions on behalf of other people's children, and they're assigning their value system as a universal standard of goodness. And that to me is we've stopped saying it, but check your privilege here. Like, that is the height of privilege, that you have decided that you can make that decision on behalf of an immigrant family who have no other options academically and educationally. Because school choices, you know.
So if you're a parent, and you touch on this throughout the book, but real spirited encouragement towards this in the last chapter that you write, as I recall, if there's a parent listening to this and they're saying, gosh, we've been in public schools, or for that matter, a private school, which is almost as bad as it relates to this cultural stuff, and we're paying on top of our tax dollars for that, but they've been reticent to say, I'm going to pull my kids out of this institution. What's your response?
I mean, there's reticence for lots of reasons. And I think that there are people who are just like, they don't want to do it. And I totally understand that. It's a total mentality shift. But the vast majority of the people who say, I want to, but I'm not sure, are coming at it from an insecure place. They think that they can't homeschool. They're not educated enough. They're not equipped enough. They're not trained. And that to me is just like, you throw that out the window. You care about your children more than anyone else on the planet. And you overestimate the training and expertise of the individuals who are already teaching your children, who are not doing a very good job if you just look at the test scores. So you're not, training doesn't equal expertise. I'm trying to not get canceled on your podcast, which, I mean, I've been canceled a million times, so why not?
But we're in great company.
But what is magical about homeschooling is you don't have to do the educating. You can let C.S. Lewis teach your children literature. There are math curriculums that are dummy-proof. My oldest daughter is in fourth grade, and it's gotten to the point where I have to sit down with the textbook 15 minutes before every lesson and be like, so what's exactly going on here? Because I am struggling. But I will say, it is also incredible how much I've learned homeschooling. The way that we were taught math, my generation, and it's getting worse and worse and worse, was dumb. And my math curriculum is called Right Start Math. Just going to throw it out there. We've been using it all our homeschool journey from kindergarten all the way through fourth, and I have no plans of quitting. It's teacher intensive, but like really smart, the way that they teach kids how to think about math. And, you know, do my kids love math? No, but they're learning it. And I'm learning it by extension. But like, I have the virtue of living in Washington, D.C., which everyone hates on. It's a swamp, yada, yada. I love it here. I can park in front of the National Gallery of Art at 10 a.m. and have my kids in front of a Monet at 10:13. That's incredible.
It is incredible.
It is such a gift, and we do it. Sometimes, like on a rainy day where everyone's just not feeling, I'm like, let's just go to the National Gallery. And my kids have an emotional attachment. And I will walk through the galleries, and my son will say, oh, that's a self-portrait of Van Gogh. I know what a self-portrait is. He's 8, and he's not like a genius. He's just been there enough times that he recognizes the style of Van Gogh and knows what a self-portrait is. And so he can walk into a gallery and say, that's a self-portrait of Van Gogh. And that to me, like, I know I'm doing something right when that happens.
That's real education.
Yeah.
It's real education. It's, you know, this is a wonderful story you just told there, plus something you say toward the end of the book about not, if you have decided to homeschool or you're thinking about homeschooling, don't get caught in the trap of believing you have to recreate the classroom that you remember as a as a student. My wife, 11 years ago when we started homeschooling, had the same reticence. And no formal educator background, but perfectly learned a person, right?
Right.
But she kept thinking the first couple of years, well, I've got to recreate the classroom. And it's a real struggle, right?
Yeah.
Because the classroom at home, even if it's kind of buttoned down, which is our approach, although we do make time for going to the National Gallery and museums, being in near D.C., the point is, that's not your obligation. Your obligation is to cultivate this natural curiosity that every human person has. Yep. And every human person in every human society in the history of the world, when they are young, it has peak curiosity.
Yeah.
And that, interestingly, to kind of connect dots in our conversation, Bethany, is what the system tries to just root out of every human. And that has always, almost always been the case the last 100 years. But in the process now of rooting it out, they've gotten involved in this indoctrination, which makes it even worse.
Yeah.
And so for those of us, whether from a Jewish perspective or in our case, a Catholic perspective, our shared sense of morality is the most important thing about education. There aren't a whole lot of options left in terms of institutions outside the home. So before we get all dire here, what do you think are the most hopeful examples of sort of the reaction in terms of building new institutions or at least having new opportunities for education?
So yesterday, I'm Jewish. Yesterday, the first Jewish classical school opened on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. I'm so excited.
That's wonderful.
About it. Yeah, I'm really, really pumped. The Tikva Foundation, or Tikva Fund, Tikva Fund.
Awesome.
Yeah, I love them and they do great work. They started it. And what's great is they have to build that curriculum. And I will get it as a homeschooler. And that's, I mean, that's the other sort of great thing about the explosion of the classical schools and Hillsdale schools, all these schools. They understand the importance of making it available to everyone because we're not coming at it from like a profit thing. We want the largest number of children educated in the right way with the right morality that we have for our own families. And so Tikva are going to make all of this curriculum available to Jewish families who are homeschooling at home, and it helps everybody. It helps the kid. The schools that they're opening are wonderful. And I might, if they started a school in Washington, D.C., I might, when my kids are older, send my kids there. But I also have the opportunity to pull some of the curriculum that they're using, and I'm familiar with what they're going to use, and we use it at home already. I'm so pumped about it. I think it's great. There's so much ingenuity happening in the education space now because everyone, I think, in the last 5 years has realized like something is deeply wrong, and we need to radically steer the ship in a different direction, or we're going to lose what's that famous Ronald Reagan line that I always butcher? Freedom is one generation away from
extinction.
There you go.
was that a quiz?
It's totally
not like
a quiz
at the end.
Yeah, it was totally a quiz.
Good homeschool mom. Yeah.
It wasn't because I forgot it, but that's the magic of homeschooling. You're like, you do that and you're like, I was just testing you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I totally knew the last word there.
Yeah. It's very important. I love your story, by the way, about math, and because that's often the hang up that prospective homeschool parents have, that particular subject, because most of the experiences that we have had as adults with math in the classroom is not great, unless we ended up becoming mathematicians,
right,
which is just a real natural gift. And so we've gone through 2 or 3 math curricula, and I know there's a lot of homeschool families actually that pay attention to this show for whatever reason, and they would say the same thing.
Well, I mean, it's funny because we have this hang up that we can't teach math, but we can't teach math because the school didn't teach us math.
Yeah.
So like the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and over and expecting different results. Like we have to try something different because the schools didn't teach us grown adults how to do math properly. And what is amazing about homeschooling is that you can change anything based on what your individual child needs. People ask me all the time, like I have 6 kids at home. How do you teach 6 kids? I'm like, first of all, only 3 of them are school age right now, and the other 3 just need to be occupied. But my ratio is a dream ratio. 3 kids and 1 teacher. If you were touring a private school and someone said that was your ratio, you'd be like, how can I sign up? I mean, is it perfect with like, can I do the same thing with my kindergartner or my first grader that I'm doing with my fourth grader? Notice how I said kindergartner, first grader, because I forgot what grade he was in. But that kid and that kid, there's a lot of stuff we can do together. We can go to the National Gallery together. We can read together. Really only math is what we do separately. And they're reading different books. I mean, the core of our homeschool is me saying, here's this book and come back to me and tell me what you just read. That's a lot of it. And that's Charlotte Mason. If folks are like wanting to look into curriculum philosophies or whatever, that's Charlotte Mason. Hand them a great book and tell me what happened.
So many resources available for homeschoolers. And Charlotte Mason, of course, is one of the best and been around for a long time. And so I love that you're advocating for those resources. Next question is switching topics seemingly, but not really. And that is the scourge of anti-Semitism generally, but in particular over the last couple of months, as it's become that much more apparent for a lot of Americans. And I've asked a lot of people this question, but particularly for my Jewish friends, now you included as a friend. It's got to be extraordinarily painful. It's painful for all of us as Americans to see this in 2023. But what's the connection between this and what we've been talking about?
It's massive. I mean, the Free Press just published a piece a couple days ago about how all of this is happening in schools as well. Where I live in Montgomery County, which I have the best finger on my pulse where I live, it's catastrophic what's happening in the schools. There are kids who don't feel safe. There are kids who are feeling intimidated in classrooms. In Queens, about a month ago, there was a teacher who went to a pro-Israel rally, and when her students found out, there was a riot in the hallways of her school in New York City. I mean, had they met a Jew in New York City prior to that? Did they know? I mean, there is something, and I put so much of the blame on this on TikTok. TikTok is just the devil and should not be on anyone's phones. And I don't want to tell anyone how to parent, but pull TikTok off your
kids'
phones.
Amen. We issue a daily reminder on other social media channels at Heritage to delete TikTok.
Yeah. It's Chinese, not just spyware, which it also is spyware, but it's also, and this sounds a little conspiratorial, but I promise I don't have a tin hat at home, it's mind control.
It is.
They have such, I mean, their brains are forming, all the synapses are forming, and they are pushing video after video after video and quick succession. I mean, when you go back and look at like videos of like home movies of like, this is what indoctrination is, this is what brainwashing is. It's that. It's playing the video over and over and over. And we're putting that in our kids' hands. And lo and behold, our kids are depressed. Our kids are filled with thoughts that, where did they come from? And when you look at the polling data of what people 18 to 34 think, not just about Israel, but about Jews, it should set off serious alarm bells in our country. And it's not really. I mean, I think in certain circles, people of morality and people of faith, there are folks who are concerned, but I don't see enough of a movement to understand, like, we have an indoctrination problem in schools and on our phones. Where is the like national crisis? We have to pull TikTok off of American cell phones.
Yeah, and just to key in on that, although before we wrap up here in a little bit, I want to get back to the one more question about anti-Semitism. We often, from a policy point of view at Heritage, get significant pushback from mostly libertarian friends, and these are good folks. I'm not questioning intentions. I understand where they're coming from, but they say, I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt in the Christmas spirit.
Okay, fine. I don't have to have Christmas spirit.
You don't. Yeah, you're my go-to Jew.
I know. It's amazing. Okay.
So don't tempt me to misbehave.
On the devil on your shoulder.
What was they even saying? Oh, TikTok.
Right.
They say, oh, Heritage shouldn't be saying that TikTok should be outlawed. I support a federal law banning it for all the reasons you mentioned.
Yeah.
Why? Because the common good and order, they're far more important than any libertarian case we may make to defend TikTok.
I mean, we wouldn't let a Chinese spy wander around the Pentagon. So it's a national concern.
We don't think we would.
I mean, we do. I'm sure we do. But we have the alertness in other areas of American national security to realize, like, oh, maybe we shouldn't let folks who want to destroy our country into our pockets.
That's right.
Which is literally where they are right now.
Yeah.
And they're not just in our pockets and listening and, you know, following what's happening on our cell phones, which probably isn't that interesting. But most importantly, they're shaping the thoughts of a future generation. And we're telling kids to be miserable, to think that everything is terrible. And then in 15 years when, you know, hits the fan, oh my goodness, we have an entire generation of children who were raised now, but who are now of the age to serve, and they refuse to do so.
All of that's connected.
Mm-hmm.
How long, presuming another best case scenario thought for you, if you don't mind, presuming that the country, enough of the country wakes up against the wave of anti-Semitism we've seen, how long will it take to really address that issue, given how diseased our institutions, our educational institutions are?
Yeah, I mean, the disease isn't just in the education institutions, it's also in Jewish institutions.
Hmm.
And that is a frustration that I have as a Jew. The ADL is not great. And a lot of the leadership in Jewish federations is infected by the woke mind virus as well. And so much, I mean, what we are seeing now is an institutional failure of the ADL. They were
the
here.
Anti-defamation.
Yes. They were created for one purpose. And if you go now to their website, that purpose is gone. It's not about anti-Semitism. It's about bigotry more broadly and yada, yada. They have spent the last 10 years focused on the white supremacy and the bigotry and Trump and yada, yada. Trump, who I'm not a fan of, but his daughter is Jewish and three of his grandchildren are Jewish. Like, of the things I'm concerned about Trump, his anti-Semitism is not among them. So they've spent all of that time hyper-focused on Trump, as has the rest of the left. Meanwhile, what have you been doing about DEI? What have you been doing about all of these issues, not just on the left, but in mainstream American culture? And now, great, I'm so glad that they've been great since 10/7. We got here. And you're... I'm trying to be fair, but it's very hard. There's the reason why we're here is in large part because of the fact that they let this idea roost within their quarters. And it's funny because after 10/7, when they were so full-throated in support of Israel, and they still are very good right now, there has been an insurrection within the ADL organization itself because so many of their staffers are like, we didn't sign up for this. That should tell you something. That should tell you that maybe you were astray for a really long time.
Hopefully they wake up.
I don't know.
It's a good segue into the final question. I usually ask some version of this question, which is about hopefulness. But I want to put some specificity to that, if you don't mind, because you're really good about taking things down to the sidewalk level. You're a good homeschool mom.
I call this the beach read of like James Lindsay.
Yep. That's a really good description.
Yeah.
So along those lines, what are the first things that come to mind when someone in the audience would ask you, all right, Bethany, I'm on board. What do I need to do as a parent, as a fellow citizen to help to ensure that America's around in 10, 20, 50 years?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is supporting institutions in not just financial, like obviously donate to whomever you want to donate, including the Heritage Foundation. I used to be Yeah, you're welcome. I used to be a fundraiser here. I'm still good at it. Donating to all of these institutions, but not just the bigger national institutions, but also like your local school that is struggling, and also giving them sort of a morale boost as well, because I have heard from rabbis who got a $10 donation from a random Catholic person in the community and said, like, my heart is with you. And I've seen that because they've taken screenshots of the donation and they're like, wow, that is so nice. And here we are 75 days after 10/7, and I can count on one hand how many non-Jewish friends are still posting on social media about the hostages. Whenever this airs, we're still going to have hostages that are being held. And I mean, you could air this, unfortunately, like well into 2024, and we will probably still have that situation.
There's little doubt.
Yeah. And so there is understandable concern about the humanitarian crisis that's happening in Gaza. And I'm not going to discount that. It's not a good situation right now in Gaza. But you have to recognize how we got here, and not to sound like my children, but who started it? And the fact that Israel is being relentless, in part because they're releasing videos of old men looking like they're near death. And they are proud of that. And when you are defending Hamas, you are defending, and I'm saying this to liberals, I'm saying this to progressives, you are defending everything you claim to stand against. You are defending hatred. You are defending bigotry, and you are defending crimes against women that are unfathomable. Where are those women? I couldn't tell you. I haven't heard them.
It's the silence is not just deafening, it's astonishing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to have you back.
I would love that.
This was a lot of fun. Yeah, I think your babysitter has a hard stop and I unfortunately have one, but we'll have you back. Thanks for the conversation.
Thanks for everything you're doing. I just can't believe you know who I am.
Oh, absolutely. I've been following you on Twitter, I guess, you know, for years now, and I really enjoyed the book. Bethany Mandel, Heritage alum, my go-to Jew friend.
There you go.
And also just a great American all the way around. Thanks for what you're doing.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoy that conversation. I think it would sort of be impossible not to. But regardless, thanks for being part of the Kevin Roberts Show. Most importantly, keep your chin up. There's a lot we have to fix, as Bethany has highlighted. And a lot of it, hatred and cowardice, but it's still America, and we're still going to confront it, and we're still going to prevail. Take care in the meantime.
The Kevin Roberts Show is brought to you by more than 500,000 members of the Heritage Foundation. The producer is Philip Reynolds. Sound design by Lauren Evans, Mark Guiney, and Tim Kennedy. For more information and to subscribe, please visit heritage.org.